We will begin tonight's program with a conversation with Jamie Meyerfeld, who is an associate professor for political science at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he specializes in questions of human rights. Good evening, Mr. Meyerfeld. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
In a column to the Seattle Times in December, you wrote that Alberto Gonzalez, who just went through his nomination hearing for the position as Attorney General, Gonzalez bears direct responsibility for the cruelties inflicted at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and elsewhere because as the White House counsel since 2001, he helped develop the revolutionary doctrine that the president and his subordinates are unbound by any laws, international or domestic, that prohibit torture or inhuman treatment of captives seized in the war on terrorism. What did you mean by revolutionary doctrine?
It's a revolutionary doctrine because since World War II, a great effort has been invested in establishing a very strong prohibition against torture in international law and the domestic law of countries around the world. The prohibition against torture is one of the strongest prohibitions in international law. Some people say it's the very strongest prohibition in international law and domestic law. And that law is recognized by the United States. It's been incorporated into domestic law through a variety of devices. So what's revolutionary is this concerted attempt to push this law aside, to come up with very creative arguments, to say that the president, if he deems it necessary, can authorize the use of torture or forms of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment to pursue various ends that he deems necessary. So that's why I say it's revolutionary. It really is a challenge. It's a way of defying 50 years of carefully built-up international law.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that Alberto Gonzalez, as the White House counsel, that there is a couple of memos where he expressed his view on the subject. Can you say a little bit about those memos?
Okay. I mean, the thing to understand is that there was a huge effort that went into this enterprise of creating legal permission to apply torture. There are lots of memos that were circulating within the administration. Some went from the Office of Legal Counsel to Gonzalez. Some went from Gonzalez to the president. And what we see in the memos as a whole is a very systematic effort to identify every legal obstacle to torture and then to come up with an argument showing that that legal obstacle did not apply. Most attention has been given to two particular memos with Gonzalez's name on those memos, but there are other memos as well. So I just want to say that at the outset there are lots of memos. But the memos that everybody talks about, the first one is the January 25th memo. This is January 25th, 2002, in which Gonzalez advised the president that neither Al-Qaeda prisoners or Taliban prisoners, that is to say any individuals associated with terrorism, were protected by the Geneva Conventions. And what's significant about the memo is not just the conclusion that these individuals were unprotected by the Geneva Conventions, but the policy reasons that Gonzalez gave to the president for saying it would be a good idea to reach that conclusion. And what Gonzalez said is, look, we have to push aside the Geneva Conventions because there is a domestic law called the War Crimes Law, which says that U.S. citizens who violate grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions must be prosecuted. And those grave breaches prohibit, in particular, inhuman treatment. So we have to make sure, and this is explicit in the memo, we have to make sure that U.S. personnel are not vulnerable to prosecution for inflicting inhuman treatment on Al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners. So there's a clear signal in this memo of the reasoning that's being used the reasoning that's going on in the minds of the White House personnel and the members of the administration. And I think the memo is also significant because it really reminds us why the Geneva Conventions are important They're not just a legal technicality. They're not an arcane issue. They really are an important defense against outrageous forms of treating very vulnerable individuals, that is to say, captives taken in war. And so it's not an academic issue. It's a very practical issue. Gonzalez understood that when he wrote the memo, and his understanding is clear in the memo. So I realize I'm speaking at some length, but...
No.
Yeah.
You want you to speak.
Okay.
But I do believe sometimes the terms are thrown around a lot, and
right.
a lot of people don't really know what they mean. Can you say a little bit more about what are the Geneva Conventions?
Okay, sure. The Geneva Conventions are a set of treaties. They're four treaties, and they were drafted and adopted in 1949. And they have been ratified by virtually every country in the entire world. And they are, the purpose of the Geneva Conventions, is to provide protections to the victims of war. There are four Geneva Conventions. One deals with the rights of soldiers who are wounded on land. Another convention deals with the rights of sailors who are shipwrecked or wounded at sea. Another convention deals with the rights of civilians. And one of the conventions deals with the rights of prisoners of war, that is to say, war captives. It's a very long and detailed treaty, and it tries to anticipate every kind of ill treatment that could be visited upon a captive, a war captive, and it creates a legal obligation for all of those contingencies. So it's set up to, as I say, protect victims of war, and one of the conventions, the POW convention, deals with war captives in particular. And they have a great deal of moral authority and prestige. They're one of the most widely ratified, well-respected, firmly entrenched international treaties. And one sign of that is that they're famous. Everybody knows about the Geneva Conventions. People know that they can invoke the Geneva Conventions in order to protect themselves if they find themselves as victims of war.
And in addition to that, the United States also has laws regarding torture. Is that correct?
That's right. Let me say one more thing about the Geneva Conventions. The U.S. has always applied the Geneva Conventions and has always signaled an intention to apply the Geneva Conventions in all of its conflicts until the current conflict. Mm. So this is the first time we hear an administration saying it does not view itself as bound by the Geneva Conventions in fighting its enemies. And as you point out, there are also domestic laws that prohibit torture and inhuman treatment of anybody, but in particular war captives. One of those laws is, these are federal statutes passed by Congress. They're the law of the land. One of them is the War Crimes Act, which obligates the Department of Justice to investigate and prosecute and punish individuals who are guilty of committing grave breaches of the Geneva Convention. These are the worst violations of the Geneva Convention, and they include such things as torture and inhuman treatment, or denying somebody the right to a fair trial, or subjecting somebody to medical experimentation. So there's a federal law that obliges the Department of Justice to punish individuals who break that law. And Gonzalez was very aware of that law and cites it repeatedly in the memo. And the purpose of the January 25, 2002 memo, saying the Geneva Conventions don't apply to these individuals, is to make sure that U.S. Officials can't be prosecuted by the War Crimes Act. And so that's why this memo is so significant, because the memo defends conclusions which basically give U.S. officials a green light, as it were, to engage in the kinds of acts that are prohibited under the grave breaches provisions of the Geneva Convention. The other big law is the anti-torture law. There's an important international treaty. This is not one of the Geneva Conventions governing the conduct of war. This is the Convention Against Torture that came into existence in the 1980s. The United States ratified that convention as well as the other Geneva conventions. And not only did the United States ratify that convention, it passed a law to incorporate the terms of the convention into U.S. law. And the anti-torture statute, like the War Crimes Act, authorizes the Department of Justice to investigate, prosecute, and punish individuals, U.S. Individuals, who inflict torture outside the territory of the United States. So, again, members of the administration realized that that law potentially applied to policies being carried out in the name of the war on terrorism. So they prepared another memo, and this is the famous torture memo of August 1st, 2002. And this is the other memo that keeps being cited, which was even more outrageous than the January 25th, 2002 memo, and so outrageous that the administration quickly denounced or disavowed that memo as soon as it came to light. Not before it came to light, but after it was leaked, the administration said, oh, this is not, we don't actually agree with what was stated in the torture memo.
Didn't mean it.
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I can talk more about that, but perhaps you have other questions.
Well, some of these concerns were raised, fortunately, before the nomination hearing.
Yes.
And he was asked rather specific questions mm-hmm. during the hearing. What is your understanding? Did he respond to these concerns, and how did he respond?
Right. The hearings are important and interesting. The first thing I'd say about the hearings is that we should go beyond the hearings. I'm very pleased that the press called attention to the hearings. There was a lot of interest in them, and people paid attention to them. I think the first thing to say, however, is that the hearings only touched on a small aspect of the story. We have pretty good evidence that the administration made a decision fairly early on to use torture as a tool in fighting the war on terrorism. There's lots of reasons to believe that. And so the hearings touched on a little bit of that, but it couldn't look at all the evidence, because of course there was limited time and the different senators had different agendas. But the senators confronted Gonzalez with a few questions. First of all, they asked him, do you approve of torture? And he said, no. So that was reassuring. And you might say, that's pretty trivial, but given some of the things this administration has done and some of the things that have been stated in the memos, it wasn't really clear what the administration's official position on torture was. And Bush has stated some things publicly that actually left in doubt whether he was opposed to torture. So that was one significant thing that happened. I thought that was a good answer that Gonzalez gave. But other answers he gave were more disturbing. A lot of answers dealt with his involvement in the torture memo. And this is the memo from August 1st, 2002, which produced some outrageous conclusions. It said, it came up, for example, with an extremely narrow definition of torture. It said that an act didn't constitute torture unless the pain it inflicted was the pain that accompanied crippling injury or organ failure or death. Any pain that didn't rise to that level would not be counted as torture. So they came up with this extremely narrow definition of torture, which basically said anything, you can do just about anything you want to somebody, but if you don't kill them or mm-hmm. cause them permanent crippling injury, you know you're not guilty of torture. And there were some other interesting things in the memo. It said that if you inflicted torture, you could defend yourself at a trial by saying you only did so in self-defense, meaning defense of the nation, meaning that if your purpose was to prevent further terrorist attacks, that might be a sufficient basis for gaining an acquittal. And another claim made in the torture memo was that the Convention Against Torture and indeed the federal statute criminalizing torture were unconstitutional to the extent that they applied to the president, because the president constitutionally speaking, has discretion to order any actions he deems necessary for national security in times of war. So anyway, it's a memo that's been universally repudiated, so the senators were naturally interested in Gonzales's role in producing this memo. And we know that the memo was requested by him. It was written by some lawyers in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice. He requested the memo. The memo was addressed to him. We also know from press reports in Newsweek and the Washington Post that there were lots of discussions convened by Gonzales to discuss the questions that actually wound up in the memo. And we know that after the memo was produced, it was basically copied onto a very important Pentagon document produced by the working group of the Department of Defense. And then that document became the authorization to, or the basis for authorizing all sorts of specific techniques that were used in Guantanamo Bay and then later in Afghanistan and then later in Iraq. Things such as sleep deprivation, stress positions, hooding, forced nudity, working dogs. We have a clear paper trail from the torture memo to the Pentagon working group memo to the authorization of these specific techniques, which are the techniques we hear reported again and again in various geographic locations. So it's obviously very important. And the senator said to Gonzales, well, what was your role in all this? And he basically said, he tried to duck responsibility by saying, all I did was ask for an opinion from the lawyers of the Department of Justice, but I didn't coach them in any way, and I was only doing my job. My job was to find out how to interpret this particular legal statute. I think many people think that his answer to that question was evasive, and at many particular points when the senators asked him specific questions, he said he did not recall, and you know, the do not recall answer mm-hmm. is not always terribly persuasive. And there's one other thing I want to say about, I guess, his testimony at the hearings, if I may. The torture memo, as I mentioned, makes the revolutionary claim that the president has unlimited discretion to order any actions he deems necessary in times of war, and that any treaty or statute which restricts him in that regard is unconstitutional, and therefore that the torture statute, to the extent that it prohibits the president from ordering torture, is unconstitutional. Now, obviously, people were shocked by that, because that basically permits the president to do anything he wants, and it's the same kind of justification that all leaders who practice torture use. They say, we need to practice torture in order to defend national security. It makes the United States no different from other regimes that practice torture. Mm. And so he was confronted with that particular question at the hearings, and I think his answer to that question was the most disturbing part of his testimony, because he refused to answer that question. Again and again, senators asked him, does the president have the right, the constitutional right, to order torture? And unbelievably, Gonzales said, I will not answer that question. Now, what he did was, he said, I don't have to answer that question because it's a hypothetical question. Our president has a policy of firmly opposing torture. He's declared his firm opposition to torture. He does not approve torture. He's made clear that he will not countenance any torture. So I don't have to answer that question. But the senators wanted him to answer that question for obvious reasons, because a lot is at stake in the answer to that question. And he simply refused to do so. So, in other words, Gonzales very carefully preserved the right of the president to order torture. And, you know, that's a pretty astonishing maneuver or pretty astonishing, let's say, position that he took at the hearings. People should be disturbed by that. They should be disturbed by that not only because the Attorney General designate refuses to state that the president is legally prohibited from using torture, but they should be disturbed by what that implies for U.S. citizens who might fall into the hands of foreign governments. And there was a very interesting moment in the hearings when Senator Leahy said to Judge Gonzalez, so would a foreign leader, this is the question that Senator Leahy asked Judge Gonzalez, what if a foreign leader had a U.S. citizen in his custody? Could the foreign leader legally order the torture of that U.S. citizen? And, you know, in the name of national security of the foreign country. And Gonzalez said, well, I'm unable to answer that question. So, I mean, this, you know, this position that's been carved out by the administration and that is being maintained by Gonzalez for a variety of reasons really puts American citizens in grave danger as well. It's obvious, and one thing is, of course, is that it's a legally absurd answer because international law is absolutely clear that torture is prohibited under all circumstances. And that prohibition appears not in one treaty or two treaties, but many international treaties. It's recognized as forming part of customary international law. And all the relevant treaties say that torture may never be used under any circumstances whatsoever, even during times of emergency, even during times of emergency that threaten the life of nation, the life of the nation. So the treaties make very clear that not only is torture prohibited, but that there are no exceptions to that prohibition. So Gonzalez should have said, Judge Gonzalez should have said, no, the president is legally prohibited from ordering torture, just as any other leader is legally prohibited from ordering torture, and there are no exceptions to that prohibition. And this prohibition is a very useful prohibition because it not only protects foreigners from being tortured, but it protects you and me from the danger of being tortured.
Besides the international and domestic legal obligations and ethical obligations, there also, I think, is a practical side to torture. Our very own David Reinhart, the chief editor-in-chief of the Oregonian, in an editorial supporting Gonzalez, developed a scenario of in which captured terrorists may have information that could save thousands of innocent American lives. And you refer to this scenario as the ticking time bomb scenario. So would torture actually work in a scenario like that?
Okay, I mean, that's the most popular argument that's used to justify mm-hmm. torture in at least some circumstances. Now, we should recognize first off the temptation to use torture, and the temptation is to think that torture can be useful in collecting or in gathering important information from people who are reluctant to give it. Now, people who've studied the use of torture as a method of interrogation say that in general it just doesn't work very well. The first thing we should say is that we shouldn't even think about using torture because it's morally abhorrent and repugnant. But suppose, you know, we don't have those moral inhibitions. The second thing to say is that generally it does not work very well. And in a wide variety of cases, we can establish this. And there are lots of reasons why it doesn't work well. One very obvious reason is that when you torture somebody, as is frequently been pointed out, the victim will be inclined to say anything. But the basic issue is that it's hard to distinguish false testimony from true testimony. So you're torturing somebody, and you're saying, give me the true answer to this question, and they tell you something. How do you know if it's a true answer or a false answer? It's very hard to know. And so sometimes torture leads to information that's false, and people act on that false information, and therefore they trip themselves up by acting on false information. Interestingly, sometimes torture victims will give true information, and the interrogators won't believe it. And the torture itself has no way of distinguishing the true information from the false information. And if you read the testimony of some of the victims at Abu Ghraib, they report this. They said, you know, we were hauled before the interrogator, and we were tortured. One interrogator, I'm thinking of one testimony in particular, and I said a bunch of lies, and then they started torturing me. And then I told them the truth, and they didn't believe me, and so they kept on torturing me. So that scenario is quite widespread. The other huge, obvious problem with torture is that it creates anger and fury on the part of the victim and all the relatives and friends of the victim and the whole society that is being rounded up for torture. And the best way of gathering intelligence, and this is a point that's made very eloquently by Professor Darius Rajali of Reed College, the best way of gaining useful information in a wartime situation or a conflict situation is to earn the trust of the population. But if all you do is sow animosity and hatred by practicing torture, what you're doing is you're depriving yourself of a whole pool of voluntary informants. So torture, it is not only ineffective, but it tends to be incredibly self-defeating. And there's, of course, lots of evidence that that's the case in the war on terror. People who might have been voluntary informants are now not in Iraq, for example, won't be voluntary informants because their fury has been stoked by what they've learned about in Abu Ghraib. But having said all that, people still like to present what they call this scenario, the ticking time bomb scenario, which is a very carefully constructed imaginary situation constructed in such a way that torture is necessary to yield information that will save the lives of many people.
There's no evidence for that claim.
Well, I think, I think that's right. There are a number of problems with the ticking time bomb story. It's very popular. It's a very attractive story. But it's hard to come up with any examples of an actual ticking time bomb scenario because the scenario asks you to imagine that you are absolutely certain that the person in your custody actually has the information which, if revealed, would save large numbers of lives. And it's hard to think of situations where you know that. And that's why people who trot out the scenario don't refer to real-life examples. Sometimes they do, and those examples actually upon examination to be phony examples. But the thing that disturbs me about that example is that it has become a way of legitimizing the policy of torture. I think that's clearly the case, for example, in Israel, where for many years, the security services practiced torture against Palestinians from the occupied territories. Many people say that the torture continues despite the Supreme Court ruling prohibiting it in 1999. But in any event, we know that thousands and thousands of Palestinians were tortured in Israeli prisons. And there was wide support for the policy, not universal, but wide support for the policy among the Israeli public. And it was generally justified, or often justified, in the name of the ticking time bomb scenario. But what happened, of course, is that the officials of the security services tortured thousands of people, most of whom had no useful information whatsoever. It wasn't that they were withholding information which, if revealed, could save many lives. They didn't have any information. So they tortured their way through thousands of innocent individuals to get to this one individual here, this other individual there, that might provide them with actionable intelligence. And so you'll see Israeli officials saying, well, it's a difficult thing to admit, but the truth is that torture sometimes does yield information that saves lives. But what they don't tell you is that they had to, as I say, torture their way through thousands of entirely innocent individuals to get to that information. And so that's why I think that ultimately the ticking time bomb story is a distraction and a very dangerous distraction, because it ends up justifying the widespread torture of the innocent.
And I hate to cut you off, but I will have to because we have another guest waiting. But I appreciate very much talking to you, and I'm looking forward to hearing more from you and reading more from you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. This was Professor Jamie Meyerfeld from the University of Washington talking about torture and the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General. And thank you very much for joining us on KBOO.
Thank you very much for inviting me onto your show.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
And before we go on to the second part of this program, which is an interview with a writer, we'll take a little musical break.